Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of Digital Drift. Today we are back and we're going to be interviewing someone who is very experienced in the Nigerian tech space. My name is Francis and I'll be co-anchoring this episode with Antonia. Hi Antonia.
Hello, my name is Antonia and I am a UX consultant based in London at the moment. I'm happy to be here again and yeah, interesting topic today. We are looking at building dev teams, which a lot of companies and a lot of people will be interested in. So yeah, looking forward to having a chat with Tim. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So hi, Tim. In case you guys didn't know, Tim has been around for a while. I met Tim for the first time. I think this was Google Dev Days or, you know, Google Nigeria, G Nigeria back then. I think 2010, 2011, it was somewhere in VI. And, you know, Tim immediately struck me. He was one of those early people who I saw, you know, basically bury their heads inside, you know, black consoles. And he was, you know, right there at the back of the conference, you know, he was, you know, typing out some code. And I was like, wow, okay, this guy is one of those, you know, you know, as they say, you know, very solid techies. And, you know, then I was introduced to Tim Bao Objects, which, you know, Tim has been running for quite a while, a software development firm. And a lot of people have, you know, talked about Tim. And I was thinking, yeah, we can open this episode, you know, with you giving us like a bit of background of how you got into tech, you know, software development, and, you know, how you got to where you are today.
Okay. I don't remember the specifics of how we met. but
I can tell you for the. I mean this is off record, right? But I mean everybody is off record too. So Tim was gatecrashing that event, right? He didn't like register for that event, but he was so confident that, I mean, it was a tech event and nobody would, you know, tell him anything. As far as, you know, he had his console on and everything. Tim, that was what happened, actually.
Okay. Are you sure I had to meet someone?
Well, I don't know. It was fun. Like, you know, this is like a real pirate, you know, I missed, right?
I beg differ. Anyways, so I've been into tech for quite a number of years now. Some time ago, I was actually taking stock on when I programming. I realized I've actually been programming when I started programming. I wouldn't really call it. I've been programming for that long, but when I actually did start programming was more than 20 years ago. That was when I was 12 years old. And, you know, I just kind of really, it really piqued my interest how computers worked. They really fascinated me. And I was just interested really in tinkering with the machine, finding out how it works. And that was how I got into computers in general. And, you know, of course, I was 12 years old and I was in secondary school then. But, you know, it's always kind of been one of my hobbies. And so I started learning how to program in the basic programming language. I picked up some other programming languages along the way. And then when I got to university, that was when I really started to take computers seriously. So all this while, it's just been more of a hobby. And I've just been basically tinkering with software, right? To solve little problems. But, you know, when I got to university, I met other people like myself. And it was a real big eye-opener for me because I met people who were at much higher levels than I was. And, you know, it was kind of an inspiration for me and, you know, to have people I could look up to and I could learn from. And, you know, one thing led to another. Eventually, I decided that, you know, I was going to pursue software and computers as a profession and really get good at it.
Yeah. So you were studying You're not studying computer science?
No, I enrolled to study electrical engineering at Bofa Awolowo University. But that was what I studied in school. But, you know, I figured out that my real interest actually lied in computers. And I also happened to be good at it. So even before I you know, finished my program in school, I actually had started doing some little consulting gigs here and there. And so for me, it was a no-brainer that that was what I was going to focus on once I left school. So that was how I got into computers.
Yeah, I think, what do you do these days? TimberObjects, you guys, what do you guys do?
So TimberObjects is an enterprise software development shop. And we built over the past couple of years. Our focus has been mostly in mobile data collection and data analysis tools. So, you know, we've actually been doing some projects in the mobile health space, and we've also done a number of projects also in elections. So we work with civil society organizations, providing them with tools for data collection during elections. And we've also been involved with building tools too that mobile health, or that rather that health workers have actually used in collecting data from the field and then building the tools that also helps them to analyze that data to help them in, you know, strategic planning and you know, other kinds of uses. So that's what TimberObjects does.
Okay, interesting. I know, for instance, the number of times I tried to reach out to you, and you were in, you know, one African country or the other on the project and all that. So clearly, this TimberObjects, you know, it's something that's, you know, goes beyond the shores of Nigeria. Is that right?
True.
Interesting.
So how is that? How were you found? How do you sort of, like, use the word market your service, or like, was that, has that always been part of the plan to get out of Nigeria and to go global, or people just find you somewhere?
So my story is kind of really an interesting one, because I never really thought that I was going to end up doing what I do today. It all started back in 2008. Then I had just, you know, finished my program at, you know, at the university. I was out of school, and I was basically just doing some freelancing work. And, you know, I got this, you know, I started with a tweet, really. You know, some of the technical partners from UNICEF New York were planning a workshop in Nigeria. And the workshop basically was to basically come and do some training about a platform that, an open source platform that they were working on, and to also see if they could work with any local developers to, you know, kind of build some capacity. They were around, they were looking for developers, and I got recommended. And so we started, you know, conversing about the program, and, you know, one thing led to another. We had physical meetings, and then I got to attend the workshop that they had planned. And afterwards, you know, they were kind of happy to work with me, and one other colleague who was also at the workshop. And so we were working then with UNICEF Nigeria, and we went to Kano for about a month, and we were there actually working on this tool that is called RapidSMS. So if you go to rapidsms.org, it's actually an open source SMS data application toolkit. And it's actually a framework that allows developers to build Python, it's a Python framework for building SMS-enabled applications. And so we actually worked with this team from New York, on this project, and we actually made a number of contributions to the project, and we were able to launch that project with UNICEF Nigeria. And we built about two applications, the first one actually being an application that built, or rather an application that enabled health workers to report on how mosquito bed nets were going to be distributed and how they were distributed, and to basically track things like inventory, basically to track inventory and to also track the movement of inventory also from one location to another. And so one thing led to another. This team had to go back to New York. UNICEF Nigeria needed local developers to continue making improvements. And that was how we actually got to start working with UNICEF. And ever since then till date, we still work with UNICEF Nigeria in building different kinds of applications using that same framework. So as of today, we've also launched one application with UNICEF, this time in collaboration with the National Population Council. And it's actually currently the largest rapid SMS deployment in the world, with close to 8,000 health workers who, on a fortnight basis, report different statistics about birth registrations all across the Federation. You can easily find that the information that is being collected by visiting rapidsmsnigeria.org. So that's how we actually got into all of this. And you know, one thing led to another. As a result of the work that we did with UNICEF, we got recommendations to work with some of the other partners, including partners who were working with the World Bank on some other, mobile, what's the term they use for it now? So anything having to do with M-government, M-health, M-development, tech for development, anything that had to do with mobile technology and how you could use mobile mobile technology and increasing access to basic infrastructure, data collection, increased government transparency. Those are the kind of projects that we've now actually gotten involved with. And we've not really done a lot of marketing per se to get all the work that we've had to do so far. It's mostly been by word of mouth, and it's a small community, really. That entire space that has to do with mobile technology in government, health, agriculture, it's a small community. So the word has actually gone round, and that's how we actually got to do a lot of the work that we've done till date.
That's interesting. I guess what I'm picking up here is always let the quality of your work shine, because that's how people tend to spread it. If your work was, subpar or bad, the word would go out that, don't touch these guys. So just having that sense of, no matter what you do, remember that your work, like, you could have hundreds of press releases for this and that, but your work still has to, do the thing it's meant to do. So, yeah.
True.
Thanks.
True that. Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Now, I mean, you talked about building the largest rapid SMS deployments, in Africa, in the world. Yeah.
In the world, actually.
Yeah. Now, so what does it take, to manage this whole, software deployment process and, to end up building scalable software? Just add, I think Black Friday is around the corner, and what we've seen over time, 2 years running now, is that usually, for those in the e-commerce space, I mean, they always have issues, right? I mean,
yeah,
the traffic, there's a spike in traffic and all that kind of stuff. What does it take, to first manage the development process that enables you to ship, reliable products on time, as when needed, like Antonia was saying, doing quality work, Then also, talking about scalability, you know, how do you ensure, you know, scalability from the word go, or, you know, inculcate that into your team?
So the issue, so I think I'll take it one after the other. One has to do with basically how you organize your team, and the second has to do with how you build your software so it's scalable. In terms of organizing teams, one of the things that I've found to be very effective in software development is that the smaller the team, the more efficient you can be. And the reason really has to do with coordination. a lot of times when you're working on software projects, you have different people working on different things. Software, just like, you know, any form of construction, whether it's the building of a house or a bridge or what have you, the crux really of that project and the success of that project really to do with the internal communication between all the stakeholders who are involved in that project. So this is communication between the clients and the vendor. This is communication between the software development team, within the software development team itself. And in a lot of cases, it's very important that you're able to manage expectations. So one of the big things in this aspect is, so a client comes to you and basically gives you, you know, a quick rundown of the kind of project they're interested in having you build for them. And one of the biggest challenges, or one of the big issues with managing the project, is how you actually estimate how much time it's going to take to build that project. Because the vendor is interested in having the project yesterday. And because they don't really understand the complexities of the project, they don't understand how much you understand of the project. You know, there can be lots of issues regarding delays and improper software estimation, you know, project estimation. And so one of the things that I found out to be very, very critical in virtually any software project is the communication that the vendor has with the client. So you really have to take the client along. A lot of times when a client says, I want to do 20 features, the time that is usually allocated to that project is usually not enough to be able to get those 20 features. So as a vendor, you are supposed to estimate basically and understand, okay, what are the most important features? And of course, this has to be a conversation that you have with the client. A lot of times, it's very likely that you're going to estimate that it will take 2 weeks, and you end up taking 4 weeks. In the kind of projects that we have been involved in, a lot of times, these projects have real hard deadlines. An instance could be an election project. So we need a client needs us to build a platform that will enable them, you know, get data from election observers during an election. And the election is 4 weeks out. The truth of the matter is, whether the software gets delivered before that 4 weeks elapse or not, the elections is going to take place. And so that project has a hard deadline that cannot be moved. Or if not, then that basically is a failed project. You know, that project will lead to failure. And so what you as the vendor needs to do is, you need to be able to first and foremost understand what the client is asking you to do. If you need to spend a lot of time, you know, going through that and communicating and discussing the project, it is critical that you do that before you even begin the project. It is only when you have very, very good understanding of what the requirements are that you can then do proper estimation. Yep. All right. And then even after you have done that, you still need to ensure that you are constantly monitoring your velocity, and communicating that to the client. You know, sometimes you have to basically triage some of the features that are required and just go for what is most important. Sometimes we've done software development even on day of election. But the cool thing really was that the platform was ready at that time and it could start doing the most important things. So that's one of the key things, you know, communication between the client and the vendor. Then this thing actually has to do with communication within the development team. And when you work, so most my team has mostly been for the past 3 or 4 years, we've operated basically as a virtual operation. So we've not operated from an office, and all our communication and collaboration has been online. It gets, most people are not disciplined to be able to do that kind of work. So it's very important that you actually manage that process of communication. And there are lots of tools out there that can actually help any software development team communicate effectively. A lot of times when I talk with other software development teams, they're just setting basic things that I expect every software development team to use. Some of them could be source code versioning systems. Git is pretty much the most popular one. It's almost a no-brainer right now to have a development team use that. It's critical, not only because the project is being shared by multiple developers, but also because you also need to be able to track changes that are being made in the source code. So that's one. You know, you need to have source code versioning as one of the very important tools that you use in your development team. One other thing, again, that is critically important are all the, you know, instant messaging tools that you can use for communication. So someone is working on something, he has a question he wants to ask someone, they should be available to, you know, basically ask that question and have that question answered. So that's critically important. Communication amongst the team is very important. Not all teams are best suited for virtual organization, but you know there are lots of things that can be done within teams to actually improve their productivity. So productivity is very, very important thing that I'm a productivity nut. And I'm always constantly looking, reviewing the tools we're using and seeing whether they're productive or not. If they're not productive, we find a way to try something else. You know, change is usually not really a palatable thing for most teams. But, you know, you have to develop a team whereby it's, you know, it becomes something that they are accustomed to and they're always willing to adopt change that will basically increase their productivity. So I think that pretty much, you know, like a bird's eye view perspective on how you can actually organize teams and improve the productivity of teams. So the other question is about how do you build scalable software? And I think that a lot of times, like I said, you know, when I was explaining communication between the client and the vendor, it's very important that you understand what your client actually needs to get built. And a lot of times it also involves a lot of foresight on the part of the vendor. You know, you need to be able to sometimes see what the client doesn't see about some of the requirements of the project. And of such, it's a project we did earlier this year. And we did that with the Independent National Electoral Commission, INEC. And this project basically was a data system where what they call them returning officers, which are basically officials at different polling stations across the country, were basically tasked with the job of uploading the result sheets that they have basically after collating and calculating all the votes for all the different elections, they have this sheet that they record the results, and then they were all trained trained how to scan this receipt, scan this result sheets, and have them uploaded. And you know, we had basically, we're talking about there are about 120,000 and some polling stations in the country, and we needed to build an application that would basically capture that many result sheets. And you're going to have multiple people uploading these result sheets all over the country. Scalability is a very, very important factor in applications. And one of the things that you have to understand right before you build your applications is to understand basically how the usage pattern of the application is going to be. And you have to anticipate things that you may not really be able to tell in the future. So one of the designs that we had to incorporate was, you know, how are we going to go about storing all these result sheets? We had close to 1.5 terabytes of data that was uploaded by, you know, all these returning officers all across the country. And one of the things that we, you know, of course, we don't have the control over those things. One of the things that we did not factor was how difficult it was going to be for these returning officers to upload these result sheets. So you have them do scans, and these scans are going to be in different sizes, 3 megabytes, 10 megabytes per result sheet. And they're going to be using 3G connections, which might sometimes fall back to Edge to do the upload. How do we make it in such a way that the application doesn't time out while it's doing the upload? You know, lots of technical challenges that you have. And, you know, we had practically 2 months to build the application and have ready for the elections. These were really, really crazy deadlines. But the really good thing is that in having the experience of building the platforms, it really goes a long way to really anticipate what some of these problems are going to be. And so you have to really, really think through the problem and think about how you can build a scalable application. I can't really go into a lot of the details that goes into how you build your application, your application architecture, such that, you know, it's robust and it can take advantage of a lot of the advances that are currently available in building, you know, web-based applications. But the most important thing to say concerning that is that you really need to study what your application usage patterns is going to be like, and then, you know, build some extra redundancy or capacity into your application. And of course, one other important thing, in fact, I would say probably the most important thing, is to build a system that can actually monitor your application. So you're monitoring things like CPU usage. You don't want an application that runs out of disk space because you didn't anticipate that you were going to need more than 500 gigabytes of storage, you know. But if you have a monitoring system that is constantly monitoring things like disk usage, you can be alerted well ahead of time that you're running out of space, and you can do something about it before it becomes a full-blown problem. So that's will be some of the quick tips I would give on building scalable applications.
So nice one. Was, you know, very comprehensive. I mean, you touched on a lot of the fundamental things around, you know, development process, you know, reliability and productivity, you know, and, you know, you got down to scalability. I'm sure there's still a lot more. It would really be a lot to talk about. But something you mentioned, I mean, just to summarize, communication is very key on the side of, okay, vendor-client relationship, and also within the dev teams, okay, talking about tools like Git, you know, instant messaging, you know, to make sure everyone is in the loop of what's happening. One black box has always been time estimation. I'm happy you mentioned that. So it's something that is very interesting. But could you tell us a bit more about, like, the working environment? You know, we're talking about building, you know, reliable, you know, productive software development teams. What about the, as some people, you know, term culture, and perhaps also the working environment?
So I would not particularly say that there is one optimal system that you can employ for every development team. And the reason for that is because every development team is different. You know, people have different personalities. People have different work ethics. And so, you know, you really have to use systems that best work for your team. I have happened to, you know, to work in different development teams, and you know, I can clearly see that for some teams, you know, being physically present in the same room working together works best for them. And some other teams, they have the discipline to work remotely, so they're comfortable with, you know, sending emails to each other and, you know, making pull requests and sending comments to each other about different things that are working and using different project management tools to coordinate their work. And, you know, they like that because it works for them. They have the flexibility of work, of choosing their hours for work. And so it works for those kind of teams. So there's really no specific system that you can employ to any one development team. But I think there are certain things that are pretty standard. For instance, the kind of machine that you use will certainly affect your productivity. You know, if you're a developer and you are, for instance, a game developer, you are really going to need a workstation that has a lot of computing power. I cannot imagine a game developer who would use anything but probably the machine that has, you know, the fastest GPU cards in them, and, you know, that have lots and lots and lots of memory to do things like, you know, video rendering, graphic rendering, and what have you. So I think that goes without saying that, you know, the kind of hardware that you use is critically important. One other thing that I have found to be critical in software development teams is your internet connection. A lot of times, I would probably even rate that number one before we even start talking about hardware. And the reason really is because I have seen teams that have wasted hours and hours of man hours just waiting on a very slow shared internet connection. Just put up documentation that they're going to use to be able to write the next few lines of code. And if you have, you know, if you have projects that involve you doing a lot of research online and looking up lots of documentation online, that can really, really be a very big productivity killer. So you know, there's a reason why a lot of developers choose you know, night hours to actually do their work. And really is because, you know, one, they can get uninterrupted time to work, less distractions. The second thing also is because there's less contention for, you know, available resources that they need to be able to do their work. So, you know, these are just some of the things. And of course, the working environment is also very, very important. I don't think that there are lots of developers who really like to be interrupted when they're doing their work. This is really something that requires a lot of attention. And so, you know, having an environment where you can actually focus on your work and you know, have minimal distractions is critically important for, you know, software development teams. So I think those are some of the things that I could say are very important in helping to build a very productive software development team.
Wow, interesting.
I know this might be taken in a bad way, but you mentioned about internet connection, and I just wonder, in Nigeria, how do you get over the challenge of that?
Okay, so I'd say as a developer, you should sign up the best and the fastest internet service provider that you have available.
What are they?
So, So I think most of the LTE internet service providers do very, very well. For instance, a lot of the work that we do actually involves managing a lot of servers that are, you know, in different regions around the world. And using an internet connection from a mobile operator, for instance, all the mobile telephony providers in the country that provide 3G connections, it's not really, although you can have high bandwidth, but they also provide very high latency. So what do I mean by latency? It means that whenever you send an instruction, before it gets to the other end, it takes a significant amount of time. So comparing LTE providers with 3G providers, you find out that LTE providers have lower latency. So you get faster response times, and that can really make doing your job very, very easy. If you have to wait 5 seconds every time you make a keystroke for you to see that response, it can really affect productivity. So that's what I mean when I say you have to go for the best. So the best internet connection for one person may not necessarily be the best for the other. So one other thing, again, that I found to be very important is that shared connections are usually not the best. The reason is because if you work in an organization where you have people doing all sorts of things on the internet, some of them are, you know, watching YouTube videos, some other people are running torrents on their systems, it can make productivity, you know, a nightmare. And so one of the things that I kind of encourage is to actually give each of the developers an individual internet connection. Now, that's not practical in a lot of cases, but there are ways in which you can solve the problem of bandwidth hogging, you know. And, you know, some of them actually involve installing certain software that can throttle connection and ensure that people don't use up all the bandwidth that is available. But, you know, most importantly is that you should go for the best possible internet connection that you can afford.
Cool. Thanks. So, okay, sort of like the last thing I have on my mind for this chat is we've talked about, you know, having the teams, how they work, how you work with clients. I actually like the little things I picked up from what you said, team, that is really about what UX tries to do, you know, anticipating problems, really finding out not just the clients, but also folks who are going to be using it, how they're going to be using your application. So that's been really great. But in terms of bringing people into your teams, where do you find people? How do you hire developers? What sort of allowance do you give for people? For example, someone might have a skill, you know, they're really good at what, at, you know, creating stuff, but they may not have the mindset that thinks about, you know, anticipating those problems ahead or how to communicate with stakeholders and those clients you work with. So do you bring them in and build them up, or like, how do you get people to be a part of your team?
You know, because I'm a technical person, it's a little easier for me because one of the things that I've found to be almost critical in this industry is that a lot of people don't get formal education. So some of the things that we talk about, best practices, a lot of developers who, you know, get initially hired have basically just learned how to write a program. And a lot of times these programs that they have learned to write are things that they have read about and have seen some kind of guidance to writing that solution. So you interview someone who you're hiring to be a developer in your company, and you know, you ask them certain questions about software development, you know, what kind of projects they've worked on. And you know, everything looks kind of good on paper. And, you know, when you actually put them to the test, or, you know, if you're unlucky to hire them, you find out that, okay, this person really hasn't learned a lot about programming. They know the syntax and all. They understand the structure of programs, but they don't really know how to program. And this is where mentorship really comes in very handy. You have to be prepared. Really, the truth about the software industry in Nigeria is that you have to be prepared to spend a lot of time in training and mentorship. Training, I mean by, you know, getting them enrolled for courses, both the ones that are free, the ones that you have to pay for, and also, you know, also ensuring that you give them adequate time to actually develop under you. So it might involve some, you know, hand-holding, but I have found that if you're persistent enough and, you know, you're willing to be patient to see them develop, you know, they do actually have high payoffs at the end of the day.
Good. Thank you.
It's interesting
to hear that.
Yeah.
Tim, I mean, we've gone through a lot in this episode. You've literally walked us from hiring, you know, people for your software development team, you know, and then also putting a development process in place, you know, to push out that product, and finally, you know, handling scalability and all that. I think it's, you know, there's a lot of lessons in this one. And, you know, like Antonio was just mentioning, there's a lot of details also. So there's a lot for people to look at and really, you know, reflect on. And hopefully, you know, we'll have better software teams out there thanks to you. So it's been nice having you on the show, Tim.
Yeah.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here.
So thanks to everyone who's, you know, joined this episode. Please, you know, share this. I think there's a lot of teams that need to listen to what Tim has to say on this episode. So please, you know, in the spirit of the industry, let's share as much as possible. You know, get people into the right process, building good quality products, you know, for Nigeria, for the world, for Africa. Thanks very much. See you guys next time.
Bye.